Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response bidet for the 29th of Av. Today we're going to see a respondent we see only rarely, Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen, who was a Rav in Jerba in the late 1800s, early 1900s. This is Shoel V'Nishal, which was a prolific book, and I just don't turn to it as much as I would, because I just don't really know him. He's not part of the tradition of Psak that I've heard of him a lot. I don't mean to question him. I just mean when his name comes up in my list of responsa, I don't often turn to him. But occasionally, often when there aren't other good options, and he has very good options, or whatever, we have a chance to learn from him as well. I should stop and pause and say thank you to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Brown, to David Hochhauser for putting this shiurim online for you. And to say that these are going to be three different tshuvot. So the first one, and they're all about, and they're all written the same date, the 29th of Tuf Reish Pei Vav of 1926. And I think it's not clear to me that they're all written by the same person, but he puts them as three different tshuvot in his sefer, although they're all from Chelek Aleph of Choshen Mishpat. There we go. Chelek Aleph of Choshen Mishpat, the first volume of Shoel V'Nishal, the Choshen Mishpat section, responsa Zayin, Chet, and Ted Vav, responsa 7, 8, and 15. So, if that's meaningful that they're all together or not, but they're all written for the same day, and they're all about ways in which judges may or may not institute things that are not strictly legal. That word extra legal is a recognition that sometimes in halakha and in other legal systems, we give the powers to certain people, sometimes a king, sometimes a judge, but we give powers to certain people that are not strictly defined by law, that it's up to them to do what they want. They have the discretion and the power to act in a certain way. So that makes it legal, but it's not part of any formal legal system. So this is going to be what these three tshuvot are going to be examples of that. So the first one is, let's suppose a judge is pretty sure that one of the litigants is lying, is cheating, but is doing it really, really well, so is about to get away with it. And that can be the toveya, the claimant, or the nipa, the person who is the defendant. And either one of them, in the judge's considered view, is getting away with something and is doing it, you know, knows what he's doing and is cheating. He's a ramai, he's a cheater. Can the judge require that litigant to make a shivua de oraita levarer ha'emet me'imat ha'shivua? Can he impose an oath? Now in halachas, we're going to see there are different levels of oath. So the easiest distinction, and we're going to get to one more in a second, but the easiest distinction is, since the Torah says somebody should make an oath, a good explicit example of that in the Torah is if I'm watching an object for you, and the object gets lost or stolen or whatever happens to it, and I'm just a shomer chinam, I haven't gotten paid for it, then I say it's not here, so the Torah says I have to make a shvuah, I have to take an oath, and if I'm telling the truth, then there's no reason why I shouldn't take the oath, and then it's all fine, and that's the way the Torah did it. But it's very true that oaths are taken very, very seriously in halakha and are seen as important and serious breaches of the world's workings if somebody lies in taking an oath. Taking oaths falsely was a very serious issue, such that, you know, when we were little kids, one of the first chapters, if not the first chapter of Gemara that we were taught would be HaMafkid, the chapter in Bava Metzia that talks about when somebody watching an object for somebody else loses an item. And the Mishnah envisions a Shomer Chinam deciding to pay rather than take an oath, not because he's wrong, but just because of the fear of the Shavuah, because you don't want to take oaths if you don't have to take oaths. So it's a serious issue. So one of the strategies that you can imagine a judge is, I have no proof. I'm pretty sure you owe this guy the $1,000. He says you owe this guy. And I have no way to prove it. He has no way to prove it. You're going to get away with it. But I'm pretty sure you're lying. So you know what? Take an oath. Swear. Does the Torah require you to swear? It does not. I want you to swear. So can I do that? So the fact is, Chazal could do it because we have something called a Shavuot Hesed. Now, halakhically, if somebody is accused of owing money to somebody else, and the other person, and he says, I completely didn't do it. So normally, if you're a kofer bakol, if you deny everything, then we don't think the Torah didn't establish a shvuah for that person for reasons that aren't our topic right now. But Chazal said, okay, so take a rabbinic oath. That's the other kind of oath there is. There's a Torah oath, and there's a rabbinic oath. There's an oath in the middle. But Torah says, but Chazal can't tell me to take an oath. The question is, can I as a judge tell you to take an oath? So whatever the situation is not a situation that Chazal instituted an oath. Can I make the litigant, I'm pretending I'm a judge here, can I make a litigant take an oath that's not required by halacha, by previous halacha, and then embedded in that question is also not only can I take an oath, but I take an oath d'oraita. So taking an oath d'oraita means not that can I create it that the Torah has required an oath. It's that can I take an can I make the person, the litigant, take an oath in which we follow all the forms as if it was an oath d'oraita. That's the question. So Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen of Jerba, and by the way, the Jewish community of Jerba is a really interesting historical phenomenon, and it's worth looking up. I'm not going to do it here. It's worth looking up online. Jerba is this island off of Tunisia, and it's got this Jewish community that's been functioning for 2,000 years, and a shul there that's been functioning for 2,000 years. It's really interesting to look up. So, Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen of Jerba points out that Choshen Mishpat in Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishpat in Simon Ted Vav, in chapter 15, paragraph 4, the Shulchan Aruch paskins about kasher hanidfa remai, if the defendant seems to be a cheater, if nira lo beumdana demuchach, and umdana demuchach is that it's very clear to the judge, but it clearly in the term itself points out how much subjectivity there is to that judgment. And umdana demuchach means that it's umdana demuchach really means it would be obvious to everybody. And there are times in halacha when Chazal said we can do X, Y, or Z because it's obvious to everybody. It's an umdana demuchach, it's clear to all. But if the judge is saying it's clear to him, it certainly won't be clear to the litigant who's claiming that we think he's lying. The judge thinks he's lying, but he's claiming he's okay. And then my experience is that if he's claiming whatever version of alternate facts or truth he's claiming, there will be people around him who will say, no, that's what he's saying, and that's what's true, and that's obvious. So, umdan mukhach is a very interesting phrase, it turns out. But the Shulchan Aruch says, yichai venu, the judge has the right to say, sorry. In other words, the Shulchan Aruch is saying, in certain cases, two people come into court, the plaintiff says, you owe me $1,000. The defendant says, I don't owe you $1,000, I don't owe anything, we've never had this interaction. The plaintiff, let's say, has no evidence, whatever it is, but somehow convinces the judge. It's clear to him, to the judge, that yes, they own $1,000, but there's no halachically valid evidence of any way, sort whatsoever. But it's clear that the other guy's lying. The Shulchan Aruch says you can just say you owe the $1,000. Im hu dayan mumche v'yachid bidoro. If he's, the gadol hador, the dayan mumche is an expert judge. Yachid bidoro is singular in his generation. A singular generation is such an interesting thing because if you just follow when people say so-and-so was the gadol hador, was the giant of his generation. Sometimes you mean was the entire giant of the entire generation, but sometimes you mean he was the giant of his, area. So let's say who the greatest rabbi of Jerba at a certain time. Is he a yachid b'doro for Shulchan Aruch's purposes? Maybe yes, maybe no. My point is that it's a hard question. But the point is, Shulchan Aruch fundamentally says, if you're a special judge, and you have a special status that everybody recognizes, or that you recognize, that's just known, then you have the right to just tell litigants what the halacha is without the formal requirements of ordinary proof. And there are ma'at, and you can also do other things in that same vein. It's not only you can tell the person that he owes the money, the judge can tell the defendant that he can't have time to establish to get a guarantor for a loan, and there are ma'at, and he can also make that defendant take an oath that's not obligatory according to what the strict halacha that we've had. And if the judge is confident that oath is there to help us find the better truth, you can do that as well. So all that, the important part of that is two important parts. First of all, it answers the question in the positive. Judges apparently have the power to go outside of the formal structures of halacha when necessary and to establish obligations, financial or oath obligations, even though the strict halacha that we know before and the halacha on the books would not have led us to come to that conclusion. Now, that wouldn't set a precedent that in these situations any further judge can do it, because it's a situational reaction, and it's limited in this paragraph in Shulchan Aruch to dayan mumcheh v'yachid bidoro, to such an expert judge who's singular in his generation. So that would seem to say the answer is yes, in a very narrow circumstance, a very particular kind of judge. But if you look later on in Choshen Mishpat, in chapter 87, paragraph 20, there the Ramah says, if the court case in front of you clearly has some cheating going on either side, yesh ledayan, the judge can make the person say something more expressly in his oath than he ordinarily would, or the judge can make the person hold on to an item. Now, this is something we got from Avram Avinu, that when you take an oath, if you hold an item of mitzvah, so usually it's a Torah scroll today, and if you hold a Torah scroll while you're taking an oath, that increases the severity of the oath and the seriousness of the oath, and it's supposed to inspire greater fear in the person taking the oath, greater awareness of the seriousness of what he's doing. That's called a shvuah benit kitat chayfetz, and you can have that at a d'oraita, with d'oraita shvuah. So the judge can obligate that oath, or to threaten the litigant in various ways, just to make sure the litigant will say the truth, if he seems to think that that's necessary. So what's different about that Ramah is, and I hope you caught it, is that he doesn't, as Rav Chaim von HaKohen points out, he doesn't limit it to a mumche v'yachid b'daro. He doesn't say you got to be a special judge in your generation, you know, the top judge of your time. He just says a judge can do such things. So if just a judge can do such things, then why did he say in Siman Tedvav in chapter 15 that you need a dayan b'daro? So the first suggestion that he offers is that that's because in chapter 15 in Tedvav, the Shulchan Aruch allowed actually confiscating money. Litigant A says, you owe me $1,000. Litigant B says, no, I don't. It's not only an oath, it's actually taking the money. Maybe that needs a special yachid b'daro, singular judge, but maybe just an oath doesn't. But then the Charles Benishal, Chalfa the Kohen, says, well, then how come the Ramah feels the need to say it again about oaths? Because he does say it twice. And if it's just that it's in two places, he should have said, well, but then we saw it back in chapter 15, or the other way around. In chapter 15, he just said, if you look on in 87, you'll see. Meaning, and that's what the Ramah often does in other situations. When a halacha comes up, two different situations, there's two different areas in Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah knows the book well enough to say, so we'll go look there. In addition, Rav Chalfa von Kohen points out that in Siman Tedvav, in chapter 15, the Ramah, when he writes this halacha, says we got it from the Maharik, from Yosef Kolon, and then in 87, in Pei Zayin, it refers to the Mahari Vayel. So he's not sure what to do about that. It doesn't seem like it's just a repeat halacha. So if it's not just a repeat halacha, then what's going on? And what does that say about judges? So he says, they saw in a sefer called Mishkan on HaRoim. So I looked up Mishkan on HaRoim, looked it up online. It's a sefer that's written around the same time as Rav Chaim von HaKohen lives. I don't remember the exact years, but it's late 1800s, early 1900s. It's written in Eastern Europe, in Lemberg. And so the fact that he has the sefer already raises one of these interesting just overall questions of who has what libraries and when and how they got access to Sfarim, because he's living in Jer, but where did they get their, you know, Jewish books from? But whatever, he quotes the Mishkan on HaRoim. And the Mishkan HaSarayim suggested that, no, that these are the different powers of the Yachid B'Doro and the ordinary Dayan. That the ordinary Dayan only has the right to add an oath to Rabbanan, Kein De'oraita. So Kein De'oraita means, this is the middle, that kind of oath I mentioned before, where you hold an item of mitzvah. So there's Shvu'a De'Rabbanan, just the Shvu'a you make, you just swear. Shvu'a De'Rabbanan, you just swear, but it's clearly at a rabbinic level. Holding an item like a Torah scroll. And the Shvu'a D'oraita is we do a lot of threatening, saying, you know, you're making an oath that's required, this and this. So the suggestion now of the Mishkan HaRoim was that the Yachid B'Doro can do a lot more. He can confiscate money and take it. But the regular Dayan can add an oath, but only an oath, the highest level of oath he could add, would be a Shvu'a D'Rabbanan B'Nikitav Chefetz, a rabbinic oath holding on to a Torah scroll or something like that to make clear the seriousness of the oath. Sorry. The claim was not only could he can only do that if the person was already obligated an oath derabbanan. I mean, he can up an oath derabbanan into an oath derabbanan holding on to a mitzvah item. That's what he can do. But if the guy isn't, the litigant isn't obligated an oath at all, then this ordinary judge could not add an oath, even could not make him take an oath. That would not be within his rights. That's what the Mishkan HaRoim says. Except that. So that's the claim of the Mishkan HaRoim. Except the Mishkan HaRoim, but also quoted the Sma. The Sma is the Sefer Miriat Einayim. It's an important commentary on Choshen Mishpat. It's printed in our usual publications of Choshen Mishpat. The Sma is there. And Rav Chalfa von HaKohen and the Sma had said, no, the Ramah is just repeating it. The halacha, it's really the same halacha in both places. The fact that in one place it referred to a munkav yachid b'daro, another place to a regular diet, didn't matter that much. It's really fundamentally a doubling of the halacha, and that really the judge, any judge, even an ordinary judge, has the right to do all these kinds of things. And that would mean he could obligate an oath, even if this is a judge the community set up, not that the litigant set up. Sometimes the way litigants find a court is they go to a local court, but sometimes what they do is they say, I'll pick one, you pick one, and then that one will pick a third, and that'll be the court. So you can imagine that those judges would have greater powers than the other judge, but the Sma is not making that distinction. He's saying, and it's also, he's saying, it doesn't matter what they came, the what that the the powers they gave to the judge don't matter. Meaning sometimes you go to a judge and we say, the litigants say, we want to know what the halacha is. We want you to rule on this case. And sometimes, and this is preferable actually in halacha, they'll come to the judge and say, we want you to hear the sides and then come up with a compromise and tell us what the appropriate compromise is. That's a very interesting halachic idea. It's sort of like arbitration, but not quite. Because here the question is, find us a medium, a middle road that will be, that is what we should have agreed on. That's the way we should have settled the case if we both people love the proper, better goodwill. And that, according to the Sma, and then this is the part that also is interesting, he says, and I think if it's between the Mishkan HaSaroim, who's a good, important Rav, who wrote a good Sefer, who he's quoting, but who's not the Sma, because the Sma is well known as a commentator in Shulchan Aruch and is well known for his expertise in Shulchan Aruch, and therefore, and this isn't something you always find in the Lacha, if I have just two people, one says this and one says this, so there are many Rishiv and many respondents that we've seen together who would say, well, it's a debate between them, we have to figure out both sides. Rav Chavon HaKohen is comfortable saying, Rav Chavon Moshe HaKohen is comfortable saying, Sma wins, because he's the more authoritative commentator on Shulchan Aruch. So if he thinks it's just a doubling, if there's no significant conceptual difference between the two claims, between the Ramah in both places, then it's the same. And he says, and I've done such things. There were times when people came before me for a court case, and I obligated somebody who doesn't have that obligation to take an oath, hold to go to a Sefer Torah, and I relied on this Ramah, and also the Ramah elsewhere says it too, where the Ramah in chapter 28, paragraph 2 says, if the court thinks that in this particular circumstance, that this particular circumstance necessitates an oath, they have the right to do that. And that's what I think that, he says, that's what I think it is. That I think that only for confiscating money would you need a yachid b'doro, as we said earlier on. And that's what he thinks, that if you want to get to the truth, you're allowed to imply, to install, and to obligate oaths that halacha didn't set up. That's the first of our three. The next two are much briefer, but the first of our three sets up this idea based on the Shulchan Aruch, right? It's all just paragraphs of Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch gives judges rights that do not depend on a formal legal system. I will say that when I think about law, I am somewhat, I guess, if my instincts are what's called in law, you know, formalist. I believe that we're supposed to follow, I think that generally we're supposed to follow the rules of the system. You're supposed to learn the system the way the rules say and come to conclusions based on what the rules of the system say. And the reason I feel that way, this is just me, you know, roughly speaking, the reason I feel that way is that I have seen that many times when we allow ourselves to use our intuition or just what seems right, right, based on what we've learned before, but we don't have a specific way of getting from idea A to conclusion B, that it's ripe for abuse. And therefore, my instincts are to be very much of a formalist, say, no, the way to find the truth is to follow the system that Hashem gave us, the Torah gave us, and all these kinds of things. And I think I feel that way. And I feel that halacha feels that way. I feel that part of what comes out of studying any set of halachic authorities, you get that very big sense of we have to follow the system and go through the sources and go reason well within the systemic ways of reasoning from premise A all the way to the conclusion, and whatever the conclusion is, that's the conclusion we follow. While that's still true, Rav Chavon Moshe HaKohen is pointing out, within the system, there are embedded, and this is just one example, there are many others, but within the system is embedded an awareness that situationally, that might sometimes not work, and therefore, situationally, we'll have to rely on the intuition of whatever expert we have. To some extent, he's saying, to the extent of obligating oaths, that can be anybody who's considered a judge. Anybody considered a judge means either the litigants decided that person should be a judge in their case, or that the local community decided, or whatever it is. And then, if somebody is the leader of the generation, in terms of judging, that person can even confiscate money that the formal strictures of the system, the formal setup of the system, wouldn't have seemed to have called for. So that's the first foray into extra legalism. What extra legalism is about is saying that no matter how much we want a formal system and how much we think the system needs to be formal in order for it to work well, there are going to be exceptions, and therefore we need to have some flexibility within the system to allow for those exceptions. Again, though, that as soon as you say that, you see how that can be ripe for abuse, because God forbid if that special judge in a generation becomes corrupt or even has the appearance of corruption as others see it, it's going to be a problem for the situation. That's the way it goes. Next response in Shu'at Shaul V'Nishal is now Siman Chet in the Choshen Mishpat section in the first volume of Shaul V'Nishal. It's basically called a Cherem Stam. So we're going to see a Cherem Stam is, let's say somebody claims something against me and I have no defense against it, but it's not true. Right? But I know that I have no defense. Right? Somebody comes to me and says, you owe me... let's say I actually owe a guy $50. I do, right? And I know I do. guy comes to me and says, you owe me, that guy comes to me and says, you owe me $1,000. So I'm stuck now because halachically, when I say the words, I only owe you 50, I'm what's called a modeh b'miksat. I've admitted part of the loan, and halachically that obligates me in a shvuah to write in a Torah oath. And as we said before, Torah oaths are very serious things. So what happened is eventually we're going to see the Gaonim decided there are situations where I can, as I'm being forced to take this oath, put a cherem. Cherem means that I'll just say, not about this person, I'll say anybody who asks for money that doesn't belong to them should now be in cherem. Now, that would theoretically mean that if other people know that this person is lying, they should put him in cherem, they should stop dealing with him, and that person should therefore feel like he's being separated from the Jewish community for this action, even though I have no proof of it, even though he can get away with it. So it's an attempt to invoke a sense of guilt in somebody for doing something wrong without any legal teeth to that, and that's a cherem stop. So the question is, somebody comes, so this is, can I just put a cherem stam in that situation? Can I say, anybody who's going to claim money from me improperly, they should be in cherem now? And I think the theory is also that min hashamayim, they'll put them in cherem. That heaven will respond to that cherem and enact it in some ways that we can't predict. So Chacham Moshe Cohen points out that the original way we got to a cherem stam is a Rambam. It's not the Rambam who did it, but the Rambam reports it in Hilchos Torah Minitan. Horu Rabotai means it comes from the Gaonim. It comes from the time of the Gaonim. The Gaonic period is the period after the finishing of the Gemara, around after the period of the Seva Rebbe, around 650 CE to around 1000 CE. And the Rambam then lives 100 years later because he, as the, you know, he is the grand student of the Rif, is the great grand student of the Rif, right? His father, Maimon, was a student of the Rimigash, who was a student of the Rif. So they're fairly closely connected in intellectual lineage to the time of the Gaonim, and they, whoever becomes obligated an oath, whether it's a Torah oath, the example that I gave, but even a rabbinic oath. Guy comes to me, says, you owe me $1,000, I say, I don't owe you anything, right? I'm going to have to give a Shavuot Hesed now. I'm going to have to take an oath, and I don't want to take an oath. So it's uncomfortable for me, and it's setting me up, and there are certain situations where there were people who would, to avoid the oath, pay the money, but the Gaonic tradition was, Yeshlo Lahacharim Stam. I can make that the person who was the person who the defendant can make a cherem stam before he takes the oath about somebody who makes a claim about something that's not true that will get somebody else to swear for no good reason. And the Rambam likes the takkanis. He says it's a good idea because it helps people not make ta'anot sheker, not make false claims, and then generate oaths that are unnecessary oaths because we don't want, this is one of the problems with an oath, we don't want, because when we take oaths, when Jews take oaths, this is a mitzvah in the Torah, we take oaths by the name of God. We invoke Hashem's name, so we don't want to invoke Hashem's name in that way because invoking Hashem's name for no good reason is a bad idea. We're unhappy about it. So that being true, we wanted to find ways to make sure we're doing so. If the person who makes the claim figures that, hears that Hashem and anybody who knows maybe is going to put them in cherem for having done this, maybe they won't do it. So that's what the Gaonim had said. So that says Rav Kaufman Moshe Cohen. If the Rabbeim of the Rambam had done that, it would seem like Kein Nami Yesh Lechol Dayan Lifsok Kaniskar Levarer Hamet. Right? We should all do that. We can allow any defendant, anybody who was claimed against, to make a cherem stam in order to do that. I'm sorry. So the point that Rav Chava Moshe Cohen pointed out, and he says the Mishkan of Saroim apparently found this sefer. You know, he got the sefer. He's got all these halachas about this. And there's a tshuva of the Rimigash, who I said before was the grand student, the grandfather student, the grandfather teacher of the Rambam. He was the teacher of Maimon, who was the Rambam's father's teacher. He was the teacher of the Rambam's father, and the Rambam heard from his father much of what the Rimigash had said. It would be as if today somebody was a student of the Rabbi Soloveitchik. So he'd say, you know, so this is an important authority, that even if the, let's say, person A claims $1,000 from person B, and person B is clearly very distressed about it, but he's not saying, I want a cherem stam. Can the judge put a cherem stam? So that's what we're saying here. Even though the Gaonim had only said that the rule only was that the person, the defendant, can make the claim. The person who has been claimed against can say, I want a cherem stam. He's saying, with Chafa Moshe Cohen is saying, no, I think that the judge can do it as well, because the whole point of it is to try to help us get to the truth and to avoid needless oaths. So I think the judges can do it as well. So even you could have said, the judges don't have any standing to do it. This is a right given to a person who's having a certain thing happen to him, that's for the person himself to do it. If the person himself doesn't do it, that's not the judge's business. So Rav Chava and Moshe Cohen says, I don't think it's true. If you look at what the reason for it is, the reason for it is to avoid false oaths and to avoid pressuring people wrongly and needlessly. If that's the reason for it, then I think the judge can do it as well. That's the second response we have about, and then that's again an extra legal power, because there's no halacha that says you're allowed to do that. There was an institution of the Gaonim. The Gaonim instituted a new idea, and now he's saying that new idea isn't limited to the defendants. It could be anybody who does it. And now that Kherim Stam apparently has power on people, right? Part of the problem with Kheramim and why they don't work today so much is that the power of a Kherim lies in the impact it has on the person in question. If you say to somebody, and this is sort of where it broke down, let's say when Baruch Spinoza, who was for some time in his life a part of the Jewish community, at the age of, I think, 26, was put in Kherim by the Jewish community of Amsterdam, was excommunicated from the Jewish community, so he left. And he lived the rest of his life basically as a non-Jew, and he didn't care. That is part of when the power of Kherim breaks down. There's still communities today who put people in Kherim, and there's still people for whom it's an issue. But that's the challenge of a Kherim. A Kherim was supposed to be a form of communal pressure, which the community said, to be part of us requires you to act in X way. If you choose to act in Y way, then you can't be part of us, and it's supposed to matter to them. So that would be parallel to in a family. If somebody said, in our family, this is what we do, and one of the children, God forbid, or one of the parents, said, I'm not acting that way anymore. So what happens then? So that's the breakdown of a family. The family at some point could say, listen, if you want to be part of us, we want you to be part of us. If you want to be part of us, then you have to do. So that's what a cherem has to be. And it only works if the person takes it seriously, right? If you start putting cherem on people, they say, I don't care, I'm going to make this claim anyway. So that part of the system breaks down a little bit, and then you have problems that stem from that. So there are other situations where you have a cherem stump. So another cherem stump situation is, let's suppose one litigant thinks that the other litigant owes him money or something, but doesn't know. Right, he thinks it, but he's not sure. So it's called a ta'anat shema. He's not saying I'm sure. He's saying I think it might be true. I think there's a lot of reason to think it's true, and I'm bothered by it. And I think you might owe me money, and I think that you might be cheating me because I lost my proof for it. So what do we do? So the halacha was that person is allowed to put a cherem stam. Now it's called a cherem stam because he's not putting the cherem on the other person. He's announcing cherem stam on whoever has money that belongs to another person and isn't paying it. Now, I mentioned before that one problem with a cherem stam can be when the person doesn't care. Right? That's one kind of a problem that comes up with a cherem stam. The other kind of problem comes up, though, is let's suppose I'm the person who the person claiming. He comes to me and says, listen, I'm pretty sure I had a shtar that said you owe me $1,000. I've lost the shtar. I can't prove it. But I think that's what happened. And I say it never happened. There was no such thing. Or I say that was an old oath and I paid it off, an old loan and I paid it off. And that's why you don't have the thing. But he still isn't sure. So halachically, he's allowed to put a cherem stam. Now, cherem stam will not name me. That's why it's called stam. It's not with a name on it. He's just saying, I put Gideon Rothstein in cherem for if he has money on me. That far, we don't allow the person. We're not making a general cherem. But anybody who's around will know it. And in small communities, it can leave an impression that I'm a cheater and I can be upset about that. And I'm not happy about it because he's making a claim. People will, cluck behind my back and say, so-and-so. The next time I go for a loan, he'll say, I don't know, you didn't pay that guy. And I say, I didn't owe that guy. He'll say, that guy thought you did. He put a cherem stam on you. I don't know. So can I, this is the question now for Rav Chava Moshe Cohen, can I, in response, say, I want to put a cherem stam on anybody who makes a claim against somebody else, which isn't really true. In other words, I want that guy to think twice about whether or not he really has the right to put a cherem stam that everyone will know is directed at me. I'm not directing at him, I'm directing it in general. Can I do such a thing? And that would be a defensive move by me and make him think twice. So if Chava Moshe Cohen points out in Kol Shem Mishpat Pei Zayin, paragraph 22, Shulchan Aruch writes, Kol Mishin Chayef Shua, Bein Shel Torah, whoever is obligated to Torah in an oath, right? Claims been made against them, they have to take an oath about it, a Torah oath, a rabbinic oath, or a rabbinic oath holding on, whatever it is, can make a cherem, stam, can say, whoever claims something that another person is not obligated in should be in cherem. And then the Shulchan Aruch actually says, and the person requiring the oath, the person who came and made the claim that's going to lead to the oath, should answer Amen. Should answer, I agree, there should be a cherem such a person. So the Rav Chava Moshe Cohen says, it seems like there are three distinctions here. There's a Shvua D'Oraita holding on to an item of mitzvah. Sorry, there's a Shvua D'Oraita. Then there's a Shvua D'Rabbanan, a rabbinic Shvua holding on to an item, as we said, and the Shvua has it. There's three kinds of Shvua. If that's true, so he should have told us that if it's the broadest version that you could have read that paragraph, what the Shulchan Aruch should have said was that the other person could put a cherem stam before he gets cherem stam on him, before he put the oath on him at all. It seems like a cherem stam, and that's what the poskim have said about it, is that it was, as we saw in the previous response that we saw together, it's a takana of the geonim, it was instituted by the geonim, and if that's true, then he thinks now, he says, usually we don't make a takana the takana. We don't add on to such things. The geonim had the power, or the rabbis, the teachers of the rabbim had the power to do it, but we don't go off and make new takanot about the kinds of charamim, the kinds of excommunications people have the right to announce. He thinks it's similar to what he found in Urim Vitumim in the name of another Gaon, that when it comes to an oath, the person, so there's something called Gilgul Shvua. Gilgul Shvua is where, once I have to take X oath, so Chazal said, so if the person who's making a claim against you has other claims that ordinarily wouldn't get an oath value, now he can include in this oath, but if that's happening, right? I become obligated an oath, and a real oath, and an oath, and then as I'm making that oath, the guy's saying, but I have this claim, this claim, this claim, I'm going to have to include those in my oaths. I didn't want to have to because I take oaths very seriously, and I also have to take oaths about things that I didn't want to take oaths about. So then I think, but I want to put a cherem stam on this guy who's being megalgel. If he's adding oaths that I don't really owe, I want to make a cherem stam. So the answer is this, the Urim Tumim quotes this other Gaon, it's the Maharag, I don't know who that is. He says, no, the Megalgal isn't required to do that because there is no Cherem Stam that was established for that such a thing. And that's for Gilgul, and which was a rabbinic thing. So if you don't do it for rabbinic things, it seems for sure that we wouldn't do it for Gaonic things as well. We wouldn't add on a Cherem Stam. On the other hand, he says, if the court thinks that there's a good reason to think that this whole claim is not really true, getting back to the topic we had in our first Tshuva that we saw with Chafa Moshe Cohen, if they think that, and they think that it's really just a way to force the other guy to make a compromise to settle the case and to pay out some money, or to embarrass him even, right? So they can put a cherem stam of the kind that we were just talking about, meaning to create a new cherem stam that we don't have a tradition of, where one litigant will make a cherem stam because he thinks that he's being mistreated, that we don't like. We don't allow just new cherem stam. This gets to the question of what we do extra legally or not. So if we found that the greats of the past set up a certain extra legal institution, that doesn't mean that we'll expand it. We don't do such, we won't expand such things. On the other hand, if the court sees a need to do it, so he thinks the court has the power to do it, and they could put a cherem stam because to protect the people who are relatively defenseless, who the other person has found some, you know, great way or some wrong way to put them in a difficult halachic position, difficult legal position in the courts. But then, and the last piece of it is that, let's say the claimant wants the other guy to be there for when the cherem stam is being issued, and he wants to force him to answer Amen, which is what the Ramah had referred to in the Shkodov that we quoted. But the other guy says, no, I don't want to do it until there's a reverse cherem stam. I want the cherem stam to be on the person who makes the claim also, that he's not claiming just in order to be able to get to a cherem stam or to get me to make an oath. So he seems, the Rav Chafa on the Kol HaKoyt says, he thinks that's right, because we have a Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch in Pei Beis, in Pei Beis Tet, in 82.9, chapter 82, paragraph 9, that if the borrower leaves the court and doesn't want to hear the cherem, we don't punish him for that. The cherem is the cherem. It will take effect wherever it will take effect. And we don't punish him for leaving the court. It seems like there's no obligation on the person who is the putative target, really is the target of the cherem stam. He does not have the obligation to be there for it. And if that's true, then if the little claimant wants him to be there for it, he has the right to say, sure, I'll be there for it. If you follow this way, he has the right to make conditions. So that is, I've gone a little bit over time, and I apologize, but those are our three tshuvot for the 29th of Av of Heif Tef Resh Beit Beis. It's the same exact day. It's almost like they're one tshuva for 1926 by Rav Chafa Moshe Cohen about the ways in which some extra legal things work when it comes to a situation where we don't follow the formal halacha, but we find other ways to try to make sure we get to the desired conclusion of every Jewish court case, which is to get to the truth and to get to people having all of the rights and all of the payments to which they're entitled. With thanks to the OU, Rabbi Jacob Brown, David Hachazer, have a great day.